to the Chris Ruggiero Podcast.
This week, we are here with one half of the Crescent Circus, Nathan Kepner. In his show, there is juggling, magic, acrobatics, and comedy. We actually used to perform together back at Penn State University. We chat about different types of performances and shows that he's done, including when he first moved to New Orleans and started street performing, to getting hired to perform at a party where the stage was a hot tub covered with a piece of plywood. So thank you, as always, for listening. From the Crescent Circus, here is Nathan Kepner. You are living in New Orleans.
Yes, I'm living in New Orleans and performing everywhere but New Orleans. That's how it works.
When you moved to New Orleans and were doing a lot of like street performing and stuff like that when you first got there, right?
Yeah, when I moved to New Orleans, I actually taught high school for a year, chemistry, and then once we kind of got our feet on the ground in New Orleans, we decided that I should not have a regular income, and I walked away from that to perform. And yeah, the first summer and like the first year, there was a lot of on the street figuring stuff out, just trying to get tips to make sure we didn't make a terrible decision when I left my job.
Is there a lot of opportunities? Is there a lot of stuff to do, like if you just want to show up and perform on the street and stuff?
Yeah, New Orleans is a great place to street perform. It's really easy to do. It's friendly. There's, you know, at certain time, most times of the year, there's a crowd to be had. There's Royal Street and Jackson Square where you can pretty much go, and if there's an open pitch set up, you don't need a permit in those areas. The cops are pretty friendly generally if you're if you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, and not causing blockages and that kind of thing. It's a nice setup. You know, it's not the pier in San Francisco where you got the pitches where you actually get to do a show, but it's real street performing.
Have you done the pier in San Francisco yet?
I have not. And all of my knowledge of it, or 80% of my knowledge of it, is from your podcast. So
yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if you listened to Ryan's, when Ryan was on, and he was chatting about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you trying to get in out there, or is that something you want to do?
I'm not. I'm really glad that I had that experience of street performing, and it definitely changed the way I approached shows and comedy, and in fact, there are entire routines that I never would have done if it weren't for developing them on the street. But it's not what I got into entertainment for. It's not the style that I entered for. I'm not quite the fit for that. But it was definitely a good experience to get chops and that sort of thing.
And did you have any crazy experiences while street performing?
Yeah. obviously it's in New Orleans, so you get all kinds of crowds of drunk people and drunk children. In our street show, Morgan stands on top of me and we get four hula hoops going, and we had a small crowd, and there was like a 5-year-old kid standing there with his mom. And I sarcastically, and I know, you know, I took education classes in college, I should know a 5-year-old doesn't understand sarcasm, but I told the audience that he was going to stand on top of Morgan while she stood on top of me. And immediately he took off, and I feel two hands on my shoulders on top of Morgan's feet, and he starts climbing up, and the mom is doing nothing, despite our yells for him to get down. And so he eventually got down, and luckily nobody fell, and we were all okay. That was on Royal Street. When we were really hard up and we really needed to make some money, we would do Bourbon Street, which is a much more rambunctious crowd, for lack of a better term. And we do another bit where, so Morgan holds me up upside down. Well, I juggle upside down, so my knees are hooked onto her shoulders, essentially. But this particular day, since I didn't wear a belt, my belt loop was a little loose. And Morgan's pants just happened to come undone. And as I started to sit up, I just hear her yell, "No!" before I can jump off of her. So I don't jump off of her, but my legs are now over her shoulders, and I am sitting up. So if you can imagine what that looks like on Bourbon Street. And what we eventually realized had happened was my belt loop had hooked into the clasp on her now open pants. And because of how we were positioned, it was pulling it tight. So there was nothing we could do. And our only option was to lay down on the street, in which case I am like now straddling her upper torso. And we have a crowd around us who is mostly drunk. And you can imagine any policeman walking by seeing this happening is thinking, look at those tourists. And a woman decides that she'll help us because she realizes what happened. But she's also extremely inebriated, and she gets behind me. And so she's now straddling Morgan also and just starts pushing on my back, trying to push my back down like that's going to unhook us. And this all culminated into a man coming up to us and trying to sell us masks while we were stuck together on the street. So that's street performing in New Orleans. We made $5 after that. It was a good day.
Yeah, maybe you can create that. Maybe you might make more doing silly things like that than trying to perform.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, so your show, for people who maybe don't know who you are, haven't seen your show, talk a little bit about what your show is all about and kind of what type of stuff you do in the Crescent Circus.
Yeah. So our show it's a duo show. My fiance, Morgan Suran, and I, we do a blend of magic and comedy and circus arts. There's juggling. Morgan started out in hula hooping. We do some partner bouncing stuff together. It's really a hodgepodge of a lot of stuff. It's a little bit of everything.
Yeah, and your background initially was mostly in magic.
Absolutely. I started out in magic, and even more specifically, I started out in what you don't see a lot anymore, in silent acts, which doesn't literally mean like silent movie acts for anybody that's like picturing Charlie Chaplin, but just, you know, on stage acts to music. You think of, you know, Dove Magic and that sort of thing. And as much as I worked on it, you find out that that's not what you make a living at. That's not what colleges hire you for, or corporate events. So the street experience, I think, really helped kind of pull that together for me.
Yeah. So now at this point, what is your show? You know, of course, there's still going to be times in a show when you can do, you know, music's playing and you're doing an act. How much of your show is that now compared to, you know, the comedy or audience interaction type stuff that, you know, is a little bit more what the college type crowd is looking for?
Yeah, normally, like, I like to open up the show really visually. And so I usually open up just with an introduction and then right to music. And that way I open up with, you know, a dove act. So there's doves appearing and costume changes and that sort of thing. So we get to hit them hard at the beginning, give them some eye candy, and then we get to get into more of building relationships with the audience, putting in that comedy, adding the interaction. And then sprinkled throughout the show, we have usually like three or four pieces to music, but they're short spurts. And it, to me, in my mind, I think it helps the audience. It lets the audience give their brains a chance to relax and do different tasks. So while the comedy is really interactive, when there's an act to music, they kind of get to sit back, relax, and take it in. So it's kind of a little bit of a roller coaster for them, and I think it helps keep things interesting.
Yeah, do you find that you get good reactions? So
our show never gets good reactions. It's terrible. It's no booing is a good day.
Do you get... So, like, I was thinking... when you're doing, like, for me, when I'm doing, like, comedy bits or something that's, like, interactive, sometimes it's easy to get that instant feedback. from that crowd. Like if you say like a line that gets a laugh, like in the middle, you know that it's like going well, and you can kind of build on that, and you can kind of like play with the audience a little bit back and forth. But when you're doing a, well, I don't want to call them silent acts, but like when you're doing a choreographed act, we'll call it, I guess.
Sure.
Like just something set to music. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the audience does just sit back a little bit and, you know, they're not going to, every time you do something awesome, we talked about this with somebody else, I forget who, but the audience isn't going to like give you like a big like hoot and holler every little trick that you do.
Right. I think there's a couple of points to be hit there. One thing that is often difficult for magicians when they're first starting out, myself included, is building in the audience applause cues to the choreography. Because, yeah, if they sit back and relax too much, you kind of put a wall between you and the audience. So you want to have those applause cues built in, not for any ego reasons, but just to keep that interaction still there at some level. I think also when you do add a bit of interaction into a music act, even if it's in the form of a gesture on stage, it, to a specific individual in the audience, it almost catches the audience off guard and makes it that much more interesting for them or fun. But like you said, they're not going to necessarily maybe applaud or give you as much constant feedback. And speaking to that point, I do a contact juggling routine in the show. And in a contact juggling routine, there's no really like big trick. It's not like, and now I'm juggling five balls. There is one the entire time. And so when I started doing it, I was kind of nervous in my head of not getting that feedback for or throughout the routine. But I've noticed that the applause at the end of the routine is that much stronger. And one guy actually even came up to me afterwards, another performer, and said he really appreciated how the audience didn't applaud during that routine because it lets them sit back and take it in kind of like as a little piece of art. They get to just view it and contemplate it for themselves.
You know, to give them that moment, I guess, to appreciate what you're doing and then, you know, wait for the ending to happen. It's like a thing, I think, in like, this, I might just be making this completely up right now, but I feel like there's like in like jazz or maybe like bigger orchestra or big band stuff or something. It's mm-hmm. like when there's like a solo or something that the it's actually like for some type of music that's like, you know, whether it'd be like a trumpet solo or something, it's actually like more courteous to like not applause after the certain solo or something because then it's intruding on the next solo, whatever's happening, where like, they like save that all for the end, and it's kind of like the audience maybe might not know that or something, but it's cool when that happens and you can actually like get that to happen.
Yeah, I think I remember reading actually a thing about, now I can't remember if it was it was like in a classical music concert between movements where like the audience is not instructed, but it's understood that you do not applaud in between movements because it breaks up what they want to deliver.
Yeah, that's and kind of move on after this, but that's kind of an interesting thing because sometimes that's hard for us when we're up on stage to not be getting that feedback. You start to, you know, for the audience, they might say, oh, he's doing his thing, but, you know, if you're on stage for 2 minutes or 3 minutes and you're not getting feedback, your brain just starts to go like in these crazy things of like, oh, are they about ready to walk out? You know, are they, you know, am I losing them? You know, it's all kind of irrational things that are happening.
It's terrifying. It's terrifying.
And it's so, yeah. And I think that's interesting to think about, you know, from not from our side, but from the audience's side that, you know, they don't realize how nerve-wracking that is for us to like not have somebody like, reinforce our, you know, like what we're doing for, you know, a couple of minutes.
We're a needy people.
So you're doing some college shows and, you know, performing on campuses. What other type of shows do you do regularly besides colleges?
We're getting into a lot more corporate stuff in the last year or two. banquet shows and also doing some close-up ambiance kind of stuff, roving magic.
You have a background, like I said, in most, like, you started initially doing magic and, you know, the bit, like, stage acts, like, kind of choreographed right. music, whatever. But you're also very high level at close-up magic.
Well, thank you. Sure, why not? No, yeah, when you're starting out, that's kind of what it's accessible to a lot of magicians, and it's what's practical. The weird thing is now, I was just thinking the other day that I haven't, like last month I had a run of like four close-up gigs in a row, but I haven't done a close-up gig since then. And it's weird how much it changes in what you do and just your day-to-day life. You know, when we were at Penn State, it was all about doing close-up magic. And now it's just different. The time at home working on magic is usually working on stage things or trying to figure out how to customize something for a certain audience and that kind of thing.
Is that because you like doing the bigger stage stuff more, or is it because there's just a bigger demand? Is it make more sense, like, kind of business-wise to focus onto the bigger stage-style stuff?
It's definitely a little bit of both. Like I said, I got into magic being first interested kind of in the stage side of things. The World's Greatest Magic series in the 90s was one of the things that really kicked it off for me. So that's nice. And then beyond that, I just kind of got interested in, you know, incorporating that comedy, but very much in a stage style. But yeah, at the same time, there's not a lot of work for me in close-up around here. There's some, but not to the same extent. So you kind of do play the cards you're dealt, I guess.
Yeah, that's that's kind of interesting. Like how you said, there's not much close-up work around here. So another person that we used to perform with, David Clavins, or David Gerard, as he's known in the magic world these days, does, you know, he does his stage show, which is mostly like, you know, he like creates his own stage shows where he goes to a theater and all that. But from what I've heard about what he's been doing lately is mostly, like, for money-wise, is mostly close-up magic at big events. And that's like something, but he lives in San Francisco, where there's, you know, all these like major corporations, and they have like events and dinners and things where it just makes so much more sense.
Absolutely. I think another part of the equation is that Dave also works for a big corporation. So yeah, he doesn't need all of his income coming from that, which is nice, but yeah, I think, there's definitely more of a demand for it in different parts of the country. I'm not saying it's not down here in New Orleans. I think there's actually surprisingly little demand for live, not non-music entertainment in New Orleans in general. It happens, but it's you come here for music, and that's what people want to see. So yeah, makes sense.
So between doing college type things and now you're moving towards corporate events, how are they different, or what's your favorite type of show to perform at?
My favorite type of show is a family theater show. Once in a while you get those for orientation things.
Yeah.
Besides just doing theaters. And that's always fantastic. I like being able to, you know, give the adults the comedy that they enjoy. It's not blue, but you can hit the adults on their level, and I might go over the kids' heads, but you still get to have that interaction with the kids that audiences also really appreciate. Of course, being able to do those shows is, I think, one of the most difficult things in our line of work. With, you know, we're not ready to four-wall a theater, and the process for booking a theater is rather time-consuming and complex, so it's something we're working towards.
Yeah, that's always the issue. Like we were chatting about that a while ago. You asked me if I wanted to go in on a theater or something, and I was just like, "It's so crazy, you know." It's like the expenses of doing that are so high, and then the reward out of it isn't much more than that.
Absolutely.
So it's tough because you want to, like, I often think, like, if I had a bunch of money that I just wouldn't want to throw away, that's, like, what I would want to do, because those are cool. Like, like you said, that family thing in a theater is awesome, and it's, like, you can create, like, a bigger thing, and it's so annoying and unfortunate sometimes that that's the case, that you just can't do it because it just doesn't make sense to do it. Where then, like, the big money, you know, is in, like, corporate events or whatever, where that's, like, what a lot of entertainers, like, is, like, their ultimate goal to get there. Mm-hmm. And I haven't done a lot, but I've done, like, here and there, like, a holiday party for a corporate thing or something. And
Absolutely.
It's, like, it's cool because, like, you know, you get paid a bunch of money, but it's, like, the most you don't go home and be like, oh, that was awesome. Like, the one I did a couple years ago, it was, like, it almost makes me not want to do them because I was there was no stage. It was in just, like, a banquet hall in a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was here, and then I was, like, you know, in the basic, essentially the corner. And alongside of me was an open bar. And then in the back of the room, there was another bar, and then there was seating, like, dinner seating in the middle. So there was no, like, you know, the main focal point was the bar, which was next to me, and the people there talking over my show, and it was just, like, the whole show, I did, you know, an hour or something, and the whole show was me battling this open bar to get people to pay attention to me, and it just, like... It was like, this is what everyone's trying to get to. This is, like, the ultimate goal. They're like, oh, if I get to corporate events, it'll be awesome. And I'm like, this sucks.
they're not all like that, I promise. But I bet you have a new rider now, at least.
Yeah, no open bar next to the, the stage, the area that I'm performing at.
Yeah. Corporate events come in all shapes and sizes. I did one where, you know, in our rider, we don't do anything technical for lighting. You know, it's just, if the audience can see us, we're happy.
Yeah.
So we ask for a lighting technician to be present to set the lights for us, and no cues during the show in general. And we got there and they were like, oh, we have lights, but they didn't have any of the lights on stage. So they had, like a run of lights in front of the stage, kind of.
Yeah.
But no actual on-stage lighting. And they're like, well, we didn't hire somebody to take care of those. So you run into all kinds of weird things, and you learn how to make your writing and your rider really specific.
Yeah, that's another thing that, people that show up at the show don't realize that, something as simple as lighting or a sound system or something, that, you know, the audience comes and expects everything to work, and it's on our, on us to, like, make sure that all happens.
Yeah.
I was at a show recently, or, like, last year at a college, and, you know, they're like, yeah, it's in a theater, we have a sound system set up and all that, and, like, I get there and there's no sound system. And luckily, I, like, travel with, if I'm driving, I just travel with my, like, small portable PA system that is, like, plenty for colleges.
Yeah.
And, like, I set it up, and they're like, oh, wow, you're, like, the most prepared person we've ever had here. And I'm like, yeah, because I know that you are not going to be prepared, and you're going to just, like, ruin, like, there was no show without a sound system. There's no show, you know, it's like.
Yeah. That always gets put in the car, no matter what.
Yeah.
I did another lighting one that I had was, I got to the college and they had all the lighting rig up, but there were no bulbs in any of the sockets, and they just had fluorescent house lights. I didn't expect that. I didn't expect bulbless rigging.
What has been your biggest challenge during, like, you know, either getting to a show with travel or something like that, or arriving at a show and things aren't as expected? What's been the biggest thing that you just, like, you know, something that you can't believe is actually happening?
We were once hired to open at the House of Blues for a band who also had an opening band, as they do. So we were kind of like the openers for the openers, to really humble yourself. But beyond that, we do magic and circus stuff. So they told us, oh, great, just use the stage, just don't move any instruments. I mean, understandably, you don't want to touch somebody else's equipment. But when I went out onto the stage, there was a less than 4 foot by 4 foot square open for me. So it was the smallest Dove Magic I've ever done. And then we ended up actually just having the people like make a circle and go onto the floor for like our hooping act and our bouncing stuff.
Yeah, that's, I did a thing where I opened for bands one time and it was like, it sounded awesome when I was doing it. And then it was just so weird because you go out there. I don't know if you had that with something like that, where I went out there and people were just so confused at what happened.
Yeah.
Like, is he going to start playing music soon? And I did like a 35 minute opening set or something one time, at, you know, and I was just like juggling and it was just crazy. You need to really like go out there and own the stage when you do stuff like that.
Another good one. We were hired to do, through an unnamed agent, we were hired to do a stage show. And as he put it, the best of your best and the biggest of your biggest stage show. It's like, all right. Luckily, we went the day before because it was a huge event. When we got there, our stage was it was at a mansion, but the stage was a hot tub with a piece of carpeted wood laying on top of it, and then directly in front of the hot tub was a swimming pool, and the audience was at a 45 degree angle away from you, blocked by Greek columns. So that was just weird. I don't know what that was.
Yeah, biggest of the best stage show. There you go.
On a hot tub, on a wet hot tub surface.
Yeah. So with your going back to what you actually do in the show, doing kind of starting off doing magic and then adding juggling and acrobatics and hula hooping and all that kind of stuff, how does that like kind of like learning different new things for magic versus learning new things for juggling? It's kind of they get grouped together oftentimes, like magic and juggling, but you know, me being someone who has, you know, I'm kind of the opposite. I start off with juggling and then kind of dabble into magic a little bit.
Right. We just traded is what happened.
Yeah.
We had those experimental college years.
Yeah. Except I didn't go as heavily into magic as you got into juggling, I don't think.
If you've seen our show, there's not much juggling in it yet. But yeah, I think they're two different animals. People might get mad at me for saying, but I think in general, if you wanted to generalize very largely, developing magic is more about ideas, and developing juggling is often more about technique. In a physical technique sense. Now, obviously, there are ingenious jugglers that develop crazy things and new tricks and new comedic approaches to juggling. But I think the vast majority of the time is probably spent learning the skills. Where in magic, if you really wanted to, you could go out and buy magic and do, you know, there's a wide availability of quote-unquote self-working magic. Now, of course, on the other end, there's also magic that takes an immense amount of skill, but by and large, that's my feeling. I think either way, when you start to get into different disciplines, you really realize the reason you're on stage, and for everybody it's different. The reason I originally got on stage was for magic, was for creating just highly visual effects that, you know, it wasn't about comedy or anything. And as I've progressed, I realized that, you know, now it's about entertainment to me. And from that, I've kind of developed this idea that the purest form of entertainment is stand-up comedy, which is something I do not do. But it's kind of like stripping everything down to the bare essentials. And, you know, if you can our job is to make people happy for an hour. And, you know, whether you need a million props to do that or just a microphone, you do what fits you.
Have you ever thought about doing, you know, I talked to Alex Clark, who you might know slightly. I'm not sure if you know him, but he was, you know, his background was juggling and, you know, circus stunts. And he was talking about doing open mic nights and stuff, like doing stand-up comedy and stuff, and how that's helping him, even if he doesn't ever, you know, even if, and he kind of said, however he worded it, that even if you're not trying to be a stand-up comedian, like, going and doing that is a good exercise for helping you in your juggling or circus or magic or whatever show.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about doing that, going into, doing just jokes with no props?
I have thought about it for years and years and years and was too afraid to ever actually start to put the effort in. But actually just in the last week or so, I've decided it's time to at least see what I can do. Part of the motivation for this is, deadlines make you get things done. So I had no deadline for being able to write propless comedy, but Morgan and I we're getting married on August 23rd. And we have a show on Staten Island August 21st at 10 p.m. So we're flying from Staten Island to New Orleans at 3 in the morning the day before we get married. So I figure I'll have all my stuff with me, but there's no time to mess around for anything to go wrong. So I need to, heaven forbid, the baggage gets lost. I feel like I really need that time just in case everything goes wrong. So I've got a notebook and I read a ton of articles. I mean, as much as one can read in a few days, which means I've taken that first millimeter step into the world of stand-up comedy. I found a group in New Orleans that teaches improv classes, and I imagine it will be wildly useful, even for just, you know, improvising on stage.
Yeah, so what's your step going to be? Are you going to do an improv class or something, or are you actually going to do a open mic night?
Their classes appear to touch on a little bit of everything. They do some sketch writing, they do some stand-up. It seems like a very nice general introduction into the world of comedy. I was thinking about the nice thing about already having a show is that you can, you know, like when you insert any new piece, you can sandwich it in between strong pieces that you know will put the audience on your side. So yeah. If when you're working on new material, it doesn't go quite as you planned, you're at least bookend. The other problem I kind of foresee, though, is that if you see a magician on stage and he has a microphone and he's telling jokes, instead of thinking, oh, he's doing stand-up, he's telling jokes, I can also see people thinking, hey, he's a magician, why is he doing nothing right now? And not really interpreting it the same way, because you expect things to disappear and float.
That's kind of it. I'm the same thing. I always think that I want to go do an open mic night or do stand up and do a show or even a full show without props.
It's brave.
And it's hard, you know, it's hard. I've never done an open mic night. And as Alex said, I need to go do it. But that's kind of the same thing. I don't really have jokes in my show either, because it's the same thing. I don't want to stop. I've seen magicians kind of pull it off, and it just feels like they are trying to be something that they're not. And
right.
That's so hard to just stop what you're doing. Like you said, what the audience is seeing that as, why is he not doing something cool? Like, there's all this stuff.
Right.
And I guess there's a way to do it, but I don't know quite exactly how to do it, where it's not built in. Like, I have things where it makes people laugh built into when I'm doing stuff on stage, but it's not like me telling a story or telling a joke.
Right, right. One thing that's kind of worked for me in the past, which is not really doing, you know, stand-up, but having a little propless bit of comedy, is being able to build off the previous routine. And if it transitions seamlessly into other jokes, the audience still feels connected to what just happened. Like, I stand on top of Morgan and juggle knives, and I use that to kind of go into some comedy that doesn't actually involve the knives or the joke or the acrobatic stunt, but it allows me to tell some jokes and kind of continue on without being like, and for this next trick, I'm going to pick up this microphone and tell you something funny. Yeah. My dog is climbing on me. Okay.
Yes, there's so I hear birds in the background.
Yes.
For the people that I think you'll be, probably be able to hear them at home, that is because you have birds that are part of your act.
I do. I have.
We're not in the woods recording this.
I'm the Wiccan magician. That's my thing. I have four birds. Two of them I retired. Three of them I've had for 12 years, and one is a newly acquired bird from Western Louisiana. So she's a down home bird. But yeah, they appear in the show, and one gets to get shot out of a cannon and find somebody's card, and you know, they're good working birds.
What kind of challenges does that present to you as being a mostly traveling performer, having things such as live animals?
Ironically, birds cannot fly on an airplane, at least last time I checked. And it's I know there was a lot of problems with getting birds on the airplane after the SARS incidents. But we tend to drive everywhere anyway, just with how our show packs. It's easier. It is pretty funny, though, when you try to sneak a cage full of doves into a hotel room, because you're not exactly sure what the pet policy is. I know I've had, you know, usually it's like, oh, $20 pet deposit for...
Per dog.
Per dog. And they go, oh, how many pets do you have? It's like, well, technically four, but I'm not going to pay $80 to keep four doves in a cage. Usually hotels are real cool about it and just let them in because they're not going to do any damage to the room. But our first apartment, our maintenance guy came laughing to our place, telling us that our neighbor was complaining because there were birds stuck in the wall. She didn't realize that they were ours. We didn't tell her, but maybe we should have.
Yeah, that's funny. So in your show, whether you're doing juggling magic or making people laugh, what is the take-home thing that you want people to walk away from your show with? Or what do you want them to kind of remember you as? Or if they could tell their friends what you were like, what was that sentence?
I would like them to tell their friends that they should add us on Facebook. That's a good question. To me, at this point, the first objective is to have them come away remembering how much they laughed. The second objective is for them to come away with one or two key moments where they had that second of absolute amazement from a magic effect. That kind of thing that gets everybody interested into magic when they're little kids, where something impossible happened and your mind is just blown and you kind of can sit back and just accept it as entertainment, as something that you really enjoyed.
With juggling, so magic kind of creates that initial thing that we have all kind of experienced as kids or something, that you know, that time when we experience, when it feels like real magic. Do you think juggling, so what, that's like a universal appeal. That's easy to understand why people like magic, because it, you know, anything is possible type thing. And
right.
Now with juggling, that's not really there. Juggling, it's more of like, you know, it could essentially turn into, you know, look how much time I spent learning how to do this. What do you think it is about juggling? Like, but people still really like watching juggling.
Yes. let me take a second and.
Yeah, that's a weird question, but I kind of pose it to myself as well.
I would say that, like you said, magic kind of has an innate allure to it. And I would say a lot of people, when they just think about juggling, if they don't have a specific juggler in mind, may very well not like juggling. They may be like, yeah, it's a hard skill, but they wouldn't think of themselves as somebody who would go to a juggling show. That's why, you know, you have children's birthday party magicians, but you very rarely like hear people wanting to hire just a juggler for their kid's birthday party. So the skill really falls on the juggler, not to impress with skill, but really entertain with comedy and then use that skill to kind of accent that. Now, there's definitely an audience for pure skill. Yeah. I mean, that's where, you know, I think that audience is more heavily in not America. Everywhere else it seems to be bigger, but it's there, but it's a matter of taste. And, you know, if you're into the arts, more artsy aspects, you're, you know, a huge fan of Cirque du Soleil, which has been growing and growing and growing. If not, you might just be a fan of the comedy side.
What do you have planned? What can we look for in the future from you guys as you kind of progress and, you know, improve on your show and your skills and your comedy? What's the where's your goal going in the future? Ideally, say 5 or 10 years down the road when you really like got it figured out. What's the show gonna look like, or what are your new things gonna look like for you?
I think it's a very difficult question for any entertainer, because we get, at least for me, I get this idea, you know, when I was starting out, that you're like, yeah, I want to be a magician, I want to go do shows and be have this big magic show. And as you can tell, it sounds very vague, and that's because the idea in my head was very vague, and I didn't really know exactly what I was aiming for. And even at this point, you get those shows where you sit back and you go, this is why I do this. This was my goal. People, you know, will come up and say, oh, have you done cruise ships? Do you do cruise ships? Do you want to? And it would be cool to. I haven't done them before, maybe someday, but it's not an active goal of mine to do bigger shows. It's not to do, you know, have a run in Las Vegas or anything like that. Like we were talking about the family theater shows earlier. Every time we do one of those, it's like, that's it. That's why we do this, to be able to offer something that is very rare in modern society, something that the entire family literally can really enjoy, from the 5-year-old to the teenager full of angst to the grandparents, can actually come together and do something that all of them can enjoy from it. And that's what it's about. So to answer your question, finally, in 5 or 10 years, the goal is to be able to do more of that, to be able to reach those audiences more directly instead of having to worry about making enough in other gigs to be able to afford a theater to perform for them.
Do you have any interest in doing any of the television stuff, which kind of a lot of magicians lately have been going that route?
You know, the only reason I think about it is for the business aspect of increasing your visibility and your marketability. But, you know, magic is about seeing something impossible. If you see something on TV, you can see a lot of things that are impossible. So the allure of entertainment to me is being in person, is being interactive, is having that vibe between you and the audience. And I think TV kind of takes away from that.
Yeah, that's true. That's kind of where, you know, I of course, would love to, I don't think any of us would say no to any opportunities that came up.
Absolutely.
Say, no, I'm against television. I want this to be the pure form of entertainment. But that's the same thing. I don't think that's, for most people, the ultimate goal. I think it's like they do that so that they can fill seats in their live show.
Right, right.
And that's kind of where I'm at as well. So young people that are coming up want to be a performer or a magician or do something cool. I always end with your advice to the kids. What do you have, man, to something, you know, you've got to the point now where you started off, like you said, your first year out of college, you were teaching at high school. Mm-hmm. And like, that's a pretty bold move to do where you have this guaranteed income that's like, you know, enough to live on and almost not guaranteed for the rest of your life, but like pretty solid, thing that you could do. And then you just walk away and do something like what you're doing and what I'm doing now, where it's kind of, it feels like it could go away any moment because it can.
Yeah. I answered the age old question. And yes, it is possible to take a pay cut from teaching and quit and do magic. So we're creating a union now of magicians. No. But my advice to younger people coming up would be to find your own voice in what you want to do. Whether it's comedy or juggling or magic or music, find out how you are and the rest will fall in place. Because if you're doing what you really love, it doesn't matter if it's a living or not. You have the opportunity to express that thing about yourself to audiences. There's a lot of musicians down here. We just did the Bus Stop Burlesque in here in New Orleans with the House of Blues. And I was listening to some of the magicians talking about how some of the other guys had just taken day jobs, and they were really kind of lamenting that because it was taking away from what they wanted to do. But what they realized after taking the job was that now they had an income, and as it turns out, all their gigs are at night and on the weekends, and they were still playing their gigs and working during the day. So there's always an outlet for you. Just find your own voice so you can deliver that to the audience. The audience doesn't want to see something that's already been done. They want to see something new, and only you can offer that.
Thank you all for listening. Please leave a rating or a review on iTunes so that we can become popular and more people will listen to us. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Chris Ruggiero Podcast.